I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Now let me be clear once more. The United States and the international community seek a resolution to our differences with Iran, and the door remains open to diplomacy should Iran choose to walk through it.
President Barack Obama speaking for the General Assembly of the UN this morning. In addition to calling out Iran in his address to the annual gathering of world leaders, Mr. Obama also called on other leaders to believe that peace is possible in the Middle East. It was a speech that covered, in Obama's own words, recession and war and conflict. Colm Lynch was there. He's UN correspondent for The Washington Post. He joins us from UN headquarters. Start with Iran, Colm. What else jumped out to you about the president's remarks?
The thing that jumped out the most was how little attention was paid to Iran in that speech. He focused, a lot more sort of verbiage on the Middle East peace process. There was, in some senses, the whole sort of buildup to the Iran thing has been a bit undercut. I mean, he got a lot of coverage when President Ahmadinejad was here last year. There was a big focus on the sanctions. Now the sanctions are placed. Everybody's sort of waiting to see how it all plays out. So I think that, he was reached an arm out, said that the U.S. is willing to engage with Iran, that the door is open to talks, but no real clear signs that there have been movements on serious talks. The Iranians have said that they're interested in doing it, but they haven't made any formal approaches to the big powers to actually start those talks.
And of course, there's still some delicate negotiations concerning some hikers in Iran. We're going to hear more about that in a minute. But Ahmadinejad wasn't not there. He's scheduled to speak this afternoon. But let's, as you say, move on to what the president seemed to want to talk more about, the Middle East. And this is as this weekend sees the end of the formal freeze on Israeli settlements. That, of course, a huge issue. Here's an excerpt from the president today.
Now is the time to build the trust and provide the time for substantial progress to be made. Now is the time for this opportunity to be seized so that it does not slip away.
And Colm, the Israelis also weren't there, we understand, because it's the first day of the Jewish festival of Sukkot.
Right.
But how would you characterize what the president said and the reaction?
Well, I mean, as you mentioned, the moratorium is coming to an end. Israel has not indicated that it will extend it. And the Palestinians are threatening to break off from the talks if they don't. So I think that, the Middle East peace process is the centerpiece of President Obama's Middle East strategy. It's a key part of being able to sort of manage Arab sort of sentiment towards, the United States in the region at a time. It's still fighting a war, still involved in an ongoing conflict in Iraq, even though they've announced the end of combat operations. And so the peace process is a very important piece of this. And so I think the idea is to let's raise the temperature, let's put more pressure on the Israelis and the Palestinians to get over this hump, to reach some agreement. He did call on the Israelis to extend the moratorium, and we'll see what happens. But I think that there's a little bit of anxiety about the prospects for these talks coming undone, and I think he just wanted to get everybody focused on doing whatever they needed to do to make sure that they got over that hump.
Well, Colm, just in the minute we have, some of the things that might have jumped out at you and your thoughts on how it matters, this annual meeting.
Well, these meetings, you send a lot of heads of state to these meetings. They happen every year, and probably 90% of what's said here, or even more, is pretty much just, meaningless platitudes. But there's a lot of important stuff that happens behind the scenes. It allows key players to meet, behind closed doors in between, public statements to get some business done. It also provides an opportunity to galvanize support on certain issues to try and get the world kind of unified on an approach to Iran. Of course, the world is relatively divided on how to go ahead on that. But, it's a good place to sort of take the temperature of the international community, see where everybody is. But it's generally not a place where, major, breakthrough agreements are reached.
Unless, someone takes their shoe off or does something like that. Colm Lynch, a U.N. correspondent for The Washington Post, editor at Foreign Policy Magazine, where, by the way, he writes the blog Turtle Bay and has just posted a piece about the history of U.S. presidential speeches at the U.N. You can link to that at our website, hereandnow.org. Colm, thanks so much.
All right. Thanks for having me. Take care.
Well, as we said, the fate of those two American hikers held captive in Iran is still an open question, and it could be tied to the fate of a confessed Iranian arms dealer. Amir Hossein Ardabelli is on a list of 11 Iranians President Ahmadinejad would like released in exchange for the hikers. Ardabelli is serving a 5-year sentence in Rochester, Minnesota. So who is he? Well, first of all, he's not an ideologue. He's a solid capitalist. Philadelphia Inquirer reporter John Schiffman tells his story and the story of the 4-year sting that netted Ardabelli in the Republic of Georgia. It's a tale of fake storefronts. The CIA spends $100 million apiece on 11 of these, a small number of immigration and customs agents trolling the world for arms dealers who buy mainly from American companies despite laws and, in the case of Iran, embargoes. And one of them, Ardabelli, he was the first arms dealer who was an insider in Iran, who knew that country's needs, that the agents were able to arrest. John Schiffman joins us from Washington, D.C. with more. John, welcome.
Thank you.
What a read. Your story spans continents. It includes secret agents like a Russian named Darius, who speaks, as you write, a mix of American, Russian, and Vulcan, a U.S. attorney named David Hall with 3 Ivy League degrees, agents like Patrick Lechleitner, a former Virginia cop, and then this Iranian arms dealer. How did he come on their radar?
Well, he lived in the southern Iranian city of Shiraz, and for a long time he worked for a state-run electronics company called Shiraz Electronics Industries. And what Shiraz Electronics Industries does is it tries to obtain American components, American technology, for many aspects of the Iranian government and culture, but primarily for the military.
And really succeeds. I mean, one of the things you take away from the article is, you know, we all know there's a lot of black market arms sales, but it's amazing how it's big business.
It's very big business. He was new at the job, relatively new, but still he was making about $1 million a year doing it, and he thought he was on the cusp of becoming a really big broker.
And so he broke off from that company to have his own independent operation. He struck out. He was a freelancer. A lot of his purchases were from American companies. Was this unwittingly?
In some cases, it's possible it was unwitting. In other cases, the American companies probably knew. What he did was he shipped a lot of the things that he bought. He bought Kevlar, night vision, computers for F-4s, phased array radar chips, which help catch planes in the sky, target planes in the sky. And what he did was he had it shipped to places like Dubai, Singapore, Ukraine, Baku, then from there forwarded via Iranian air to Tehran.
This is something called transshipping.
Right.
Yeah. And as you write, some American companies figured out he was, you know, an Iranian. Of course, we have the embargo. And, you know, maybe even took his deposit money, didn't give it back. But then one day, one of those companies does contact these agents. To pick up the story from there.
Well, there was a company that was in Philadelphia that got an inquiry from Amir Ardabelli, and who was calling himself Alex Dave. They all use Americanized names. The American who got the query was very suspicious, and so he called Homeland Security, Immigration Customs Enforcement, it's called ICE, and he called the agents locally in Philadelphia, and they had an undercover operation going, and so he, instead of rejecting the query, they asked him to string him along a little bit and to refer him to their undercover operation, which was in suburban Philadelphia.
Right. Now, tell us more about this undercover operation. We mentioned the U.S. attorney, David Hall. You've got an Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent, an ICE agent, Patrick Lechleitner.
Sure. They set up a storefront between a dentist and a chiropractor in a very suburban strip mall area in Philadelphia. And the reason that they did that was because brokers for Iranians, Chinese, North Koreans, they're smart. You can't just set up some fake website and expect them to come walking in. So they littered it with Jane's Fighting Ships, Encyclopedia of Modern War. They had backdated tax records. They had cards. They had everything printed up so that if somebody wandered in the door, they would believe that this really was an arms brokerage. They also, the thing that I think that really sold this was they also set up a second undercover storefront. They set it up in a northern European country. And that's where Darius comes in, who speaks fluent Russian and is a quite excitable character. And he's also an undercover ICE agent.
A lot of money is going into trying to ensnare these arms dealers. Remind us why. I mean, it would seem obvious, but why in particular was it so important to get someone from inside Iran?
On the modern battlefield, one of the biggest dangers that U.S. troops face is the enemy having U.S. technology, because we make the best stuff. We make the most high-tech components that can make the vest, the night vision, makes the gyros that make the missiles land where they're supposed to land, the radar that can see attacking planes in the sky. And this is the whole reason that ICE has this counterproliferation unit, is to try to stop America's current and future enemies from trying to acquire this gear.
Well, in fact, they've traced American technology to Iran and from there on to deadly roadside bombs in Iraq.
That's right. The Pentagon and the Justice Department have traced components used and manufactured in Arizona to roadside bombs in Iraq and Afghanistan, that these components are used as the remote control triggers. And in fact, even in the Artabelli case, they were able to find that Artabelli had ordered about 120 of these components from a company in Arizona. That company was probably unwitting.
Well, in addition to that, this is Iran. So American officials, of course, really want to know, where is Iran on its nuclear weapons program? And so the hope was that by bagging an Iranian arms dealer, they would get closer to that kind of information. So along comes Amir Hossein Artabelli, who is now making these pitches to Darius at this fake storefront. And he's making so many pitches, we understand, that they name him Shakespeare?
Right. What the arms brokers usually do is they send a request for quotes. How much money will it cost to buy this item or that item? He was one of the most prolific they had ever seen, and so one of the agents nicknamed him Shakespeare. Therefore, the operation was called Operation Shakespeare.
Right. Shakespeare because he had so many quotes.
So many quotes.
Right. Well, so the operation is going along. Pick it up then. What happens? When do they actually come in contact with him, and how? What kind of materials are they bringing to him?
Well, in October of 2007, they were successfully able to lure him outside of Iran. This was the sticking point. He wanted to meet inside Iran. They, of course, couldn't run a sting operation inside Iran. So they lured him to the Republic of Georgia. And this was sort of a perfect place because it was on the halfway in Europe, halfway in Asia. And it was also, at the time in 2007, a very big American ally. The highway from the airport to downtown Tbilisi, which is the capital, is called George W. Bush Boulevard. So it was a very good place for the Americans to lure him, but also close to Iran. They lured him to Tbilisi with the promise of selling him computer upgrades for F-4 fighters, for the gyroscopes that are used to direct missiles, and for the phased array radar chips, which are the devices that help see airplanes in the sky.
And these weren't entirely real chips. They contacted an American company, and the American company agreed to make, you know, a few real chips to go on top of the box, and the rest were fakes.
That's right. It's almost a scene out of a movie.
It is.
The ICE agents, you'd think that they could come up with this technology very quickly to offer in a sting operation, but actually it's very expensive, and the military doesn't have a lot of this stuff lying around. So the manufacturer in Boston came up with this great idea of having 10 real chips on the top and 999 fake ones below.
So that's an American company that helped, but you also report that ITT Tech was fined $100 million for repeatedly illegally selling night vision goggles to China. Fascinating. John Schiffman's series on black market arms dealers is in the Philly Inquirer this week. When we come back, more on the arrest of the Iranian, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been talking to reporter John Schiffman about convicted Iranian arms smuggler Amir Hossein Artabelli. Schiffman details the four-year sting that led to Artabelli's arrest in 2007 in the Republic of Georgia in the Philadelphia Inquirer this week. And John, you write that these American agents who were heading to Georgia, including Darius, who spoke Russian, weren't entirely sure what they'd find in Artabelli. You know, was he an Iranian spy? But they were well prepared.
Darius, the undercover agent, believed that when he went undercover, he would try to create an illusion so real that somebody would tell you anything. He called it the magic show. And so what happened is that by the time they've met with Artabelli, they've been talking to him for 2 years by telephone and by email, and they get inside the hotel room, and the Americans act dumb, and they say, how does this work? How do you do this? You're a genius. And Artabelli lays it out. And in fact, in one very telling scene, he lays out much of the Iranian procurement network, and then he looks up at Darius and he says, please keep this very secret in your pocket, otherwise customer will kill me. And the customer is the government of Iran.
Right.
And so I think the agents were surprised how much he ended up telling them. But I think it's also a bit of a clash of two cultures, because even though the American undercover agents, to make their criminal case, kept saying, you know, this is illegal, this is really illegal, Artabelli didn't seem to care. And even when I talk to him now, he says, well, it wasn't illegal in Iran, and so if you drink a bottle of wine in the United States, that's illegal in Iran. Should Iran be able to come and arrest you and bring you to Iran?
At a certain point, the agents had to get, he called himself Alex Dave, they called him Shakespeare. They had to get him to admit on tape several things. You were just mentioning some of them. Did he know it was illegal? Did he admit that he had sent the emails, to admit that he was purchasing arms? He did it all. Nothing ever set off an alarm in him.
No, in fact, the only thing that seems to have set off the alarm was when they raised the issue of nuclear technology. He raised it because he had originally mentioned it in a very old email. And when the agents raised that issue again, he says, well, I can get you anything, but maybe it's not so good to hurt anybody. And he backed off on anything nuclear.
Well, you give us all these details. Darius, again, the Russian who's helping in this sting, gives the Iranian a SIM card for his phone. And the guy says, oh, thanks, and puts it in, which now means that every call and movement he makes in Georgia can be traced by the Americans. He just didn't seem to get any of this. This is during the Bush administration. And you detail sort of a flare-up that occurs because Washington wants to make a big deal about this. They want to have a press conference. Tell us about sort of the interaction between these agents and their bosses in Washington.
As the sting is unfolding, and the sting unfolds over a two-day period because there's a lot to say, there's a lot to learn, a political appointee in Washington calls up to Wilmington to political appointees there and notifies them that this is great, it's all going well, we'd like to throw a press conference to announce this and to discourage others and to show what we're doing. And Dave Hall is a prosecutor. He's on the scene in Tbilisi, and he gets a call from his bosses in Wilmington. And everybody is very upset and worried that this could blow everything because they don't know what Artabelli will tell them or what they'll find on his laptop. And it could be extraordinary. And so one of the agents says, this isn't just a traffic stop. We didn't do this just to get one guy. We want to find out about the whole network.
So what happened? Was the press conference called?
It wasn't. Ultimately, they prevailed once they got back to Philadelphia and they realized how much information they had on Artabelli's laptop.
Well, tell us about that. Ultimately, the doors are thrown open and it's revealed to him that he was in a sting. They confiscate his laptop. Dozens of agents come in. They do all sorts of high-tech things to strip it. What did they find?
They found an extraordinary amount of information, about over 101,000 files. They found 33 bank transfers sent from Tehran to Germany. They found transactions involving 70 companies. 16 of them had big contracts with the Pentagon. They identified 24 Iranian procurement agents and about 50 Iranian government subsidiaries buying weapons and components for the Islamic Republic.
Did they find things that told them new information about Iran's nuclear program?
They didn't find anything. They didn't know what they would find. They did not find anything about the nuclear program.
And you seem to have spoken to both Artabelli and his wife.
Yeah, I met with Nagina Artabelli, and I've spoken with her on the phone many times and emailed. She came to the United States after her husband ended up in the United States. And she's very concerned, but also is very confused.
Did she profess not to know what he did?
She doesn't believe that he's broken any laws, and she believes that the case is political. She believes that he was arrested as part of an American government initiative to embarrass Iran. The thing that I found most extraordinary about this case was that Amir Artabelli was held in secret in the United States for 22 months in solitary confinement under a fake name, Hussein Shiraz. And I didn't know that the U.S. government could hold someone that long, let alone under a fake name, unless we were talking about something like Guantanamo.
One wonders who else.
Well, sure.
What do you think the chances are that there will be a trade, the American hikers in Iran for Artabelli and other Iranians?
It's a really good question. I mean, it's been floated. One would think that the Americans don't have too much to gain from Artabelli remaining in prison and a lot to gain from getting the hiker back. So at this point, the president could commute the sentence, or I suppose the prosecution could go back and ask for a resentencing.
One wonders what his fate might be back in Iran, given that he's given up so much of Iranian's military secrets through his laptop.
I asked him about that, and he said, there's no reason I couldn't go back to Iran. I'm definitely going back to Iran. He's not had a very pleasant experience either in the Georgian prisons or the U.S. prisons. He was held in solitary confinement for about 20 months, and he has serious physical issues. Whether those would get fixed once he's released, I don't know. The judge at sentencing said, you know, you are really a man without a country.
John Schiffman speaking of Iranian arms dealer Amir Hossein Ardabelli. John's 8-part series in the Philadelphia Inquirer concludes this Sunday. John's also the author of the summer's best-selling book, Priceless, about the FBI's art crime team. We can link you to more about all of his work at hereandnow.org. John, thank you.
Thank you.
Economist Larry Summers will leave his position as director of the National Economic Council after the midterm elections, head back to Harvard, where he was once president and will now teach. By the way, you can get a sense of Summers' legendary abrasive style in the new movie about Facebook, The Social Network. There's a scene in which his character brusquely questions whether some of the Facebook co-creators can make millions and then throws them out of his office. But who will replace him in the White House, and what will that choice mean? Peter Morici is professor of public policy at the University of Maryland's Business School. Peter, first tell us what the job entails. You describe it as gatekeeper.
The chairman of the National Economic Council provides the president with a daily brief on the economy, just as he receives a national security brief. All this information you see flowing, consumer price index, GDP, industrial production, it's up to the person in Summers' job to distill that into a format the president can understand and use to make decisions. Also, at various times, the chairman has been the president's principal economic policymaker. That is not necessary. It's important, though, that this person have a technical economics background, because a great deal of the information provided to the president has to be translated. It comes in forms that only an economist can fully distill.
That last phrase, that thinking, plays into some of your thinking about the choices. But before we look ahead, let's just wrap up for a second some of the things he's either credited or blamed for. The views are all over the political spectrum. You have author Neil Ferguson saying, as one of the architects of the stimulus package, Larry Summers helped save us from the Great Depression. On the other hand, you have businessman Theodore Forstman. Both are quoted in the Daily Beast saying that Summers should be replaced by someone who doesn't believe that spending creates growth, because he, Forstman, doesn't believe it does. So take some of that thinking going forward. Who are some of the candidates, and what will it mean if they're chosen?
Most importantly, the president is a progressive, and he's going to have an economic policy that bears that stamp. So it's foolish to think that we can replace Larry Summers with a free market conservative and that we won't have Keynesian spending. We're going to have that approach to economic policy as long as Barack Obama is president of the United States.
Well, start with some of the candidates then. You've got Anne Mulcahy, former CEO of Xerox. Thoughts?
Anne Mulcahy would not be a good choice because she doesn't have the deep understanding of the economy as a business executive than an economist would have. It's a different skill. Think of it as a football team. She's a wide receiver. This is a position for a running back. If Anne Mulcahy goes in that job, then the deputy is really going to be the person that briefs the president.
Well, speaking of deputy, Larry Summers' deputy, Diana Farrell, is another name that's been floated around. She came from the consulting firm McKinsey. Thoughts on her?
One of the views in business is that the president, in addition to stimulus, is going to have to fix structural problems, the outsourcing problem, trade with China, and the broken banks. Diana is not someone who we would look to fix those kinds of problems. She's a champion of outsourcing. If the president goes with Diana Farrell, it's an indication that all of this talk about fixing the China trade problem is just that, talk.
Laura Tyson is another name mentioned. She's an economist at the University of California, Berkeley, was a key member of President Clinton's economic team. Your thoughts?
Well, Laura Tyson has a track record that would indicate that she would be sympathetic to the president's view about stimulus. During her Clinton years, she was a strong advocate of playing hardball with the Japanese for the kinds of practices the Chinese are now pursuing. But in recent years, Laura Tyson has become more aligned with the New York banks. So there's some concern as to whether Laura Tyson has changed her stripes.
So you say you prefer Laura Tyson, but the best person for the job may be Princeton economist Alan Blinder, who also served in the Clinton White House. Why?
Well, Alan Blinder would be inclined to tell the president the limitations of some of the kinds of things he's trying to do. I want to make it clear that Keynesianism and stimulus has gotten a bad name in the last several months because the administration, with the help of Congress, has not really carefully crafted stimulus spending. It can be effective.
Well, and as you well know, Peter, there are people, Mort Zuckerman comes to mind, U.S. News and World Report, say that it wasn't big enough, that there had to be more spending.
Yeah, it's not a matter of it being bigger. Give me $800 billion. It would be hard to bump into someone on the street that didn't have his job coming from me if it was properly structured. My feeling is that Alan Blinder is more likely to give the president the kind of advice that he needs to hear, even if he doesn't want to hear it. It's not how big it is. It's how much effect we accomplish.
Peter Morici, professor of public policy at the University of Maryland's Business School, taking a look at some of the candidates who might replace Larry Summers. Peter, thanks as always.
Take care.
And in a few minutes, mangled words. You can go to hearnow.org, click on the upper right, and weigh in with yours. But we'll be back in 30 seconds here and now. Countries closest to the North Pole are holding a summit in Moscow to discuss how to share riches that are now more accessible because of global warming. Russia, Norway, Denmark, the U.S. and Canada have competing claims over Arctic territory that's believed to hold a quarter of the Earth's untapped oil and gas reserves. Canada wants to control the valuable shipping routes. Well, the BBC's Rajesh Mirchandi joined a supply ship in Hudson Bay and sent this report.
It's just before midnight and I've just boarded a boat in the tiny Arctic port of Churchill on Canada's Hudson Bay. On the water behind me I can see an enormous open-topped barge and there are prefabricated shelters on it. There's a couple of vehicles, there's even a forklift truck, and we're going to tow all this equipment north towards the Arctic Ocean and the isolated communities that live there.
You like your country music?
Love it. I love it.
On the bridge, Captain Richard Lambert keeps watch through the dark night.
I can listen to it all night. Yeah.
Small ships like his are a lifeline in Canada's remote north, but he predicts upheaval.
Global warming is going to change the face of the north. The tug and barge industry will be reduced because larger ships can come and they'll bring more cargo in bulk. Ships are going to be able to leave Atlantic Canada, go to the Pacific coast, through the north, which they could never do before. The Northwest Passage was open last year. A couple of tugs did get through. But yes, it's going to happen very shortly.
We've been going for about 12 hours now, and I can see nothing except the slate grey of the sea in all directions. In a few weeks, this journey won't even be possible because the sea from here to the pole freezes. Now, for centuries, sailors have been searching for an ice-free route in the summer through the Arctic. Now, as more ice melts, Canada knows how strategically important that Northwest Passage could be.
We live in a time of renewed foreign interest in Canada's Arctic.
Canada's Prime Minister Stephen Harper recently stressed his country's claims on Arctic waterways, including the Northwest Passage. It was a signal to countries, including Russia and America, who want open access. Canada recently held military exercises in the area and is buying new patrol boats.
All these efforts are toward one non-negotiable priority, and that is the protection and promotion of Canada's sovereignty over what is our north.
So finally, after 20 hours of travelling, we've arrived in Arviat. I'd say it's a practical town rather than pretty, full of weathered houses and rough dirt roads. This is a native Inuit community. You hear their language spoken all over, and women are wearing traditional coats with big hoods to carry babies. But they're speeding around on bikes. It's a mix of the ancient and the new. Canada supports strong native cultures. It's also a way of reinforcing its ownership of the North. There's a local radio station in Arviat, and this is the most popular show.
Game number 2, Adalhet, Nipingata Ngwa, Namimeak, Itu Luak, top $100.
Inuit language bingo.
Good bingo.
The jackpot is $3,500, tempting in a place where life is actually quite hard. Bingo caller Jenny Kalawak says people need the government as much as it needs them.
The cost of food, it's very expensive, and I'm not sure, but I would say 75% of people that live here are on welfare. So there's barely any jobs.
Without the federal government, what would happen?
People be starving.
Well, I'm back on the boat now and homeward bound. My journey is nearly over. But the gold rush in the Arctic is just starting, and I've seen firsthand how Canada is staking its claim.
That report from the BBC's Rajesh Mirchandi. Yesterday, we asked, what are your favorite mangled words? You can still weigh in at herenow.org, as Richard from Mississippi did. He hates it when people use mute, as in silence, instead of moot, as in moot point. Well, the editors of the American Heritage Dictionary have several new books of mangled or mispronounced words. Steve Kleinedler is here to help. Steve, what are some of your favorite misuses?
I'm always amazed at how worked up people get over the term irregardless. Some people feel it's redundant. Other people feel it's a double negative. Something's regardless. You're throwing this IR prefix in front of it. True. It's a non-standard word. It always will because so many people are against it. But the truth of the matter is no one complains about the fact that unravel means the same thing as ravel or debone means the same thing as bone. And yet irregardless has taken on kind of this status of just a word that one must never utter.
Well, okay, but we have to have some standards. And
absolutely.
It, you know, regardless is just fine.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely. Right. I'm not saying that it's bad that we say that it's non-standard. I'm just merely pointing out that people's logic behind it doesn't hold up across the language.
Well, we ask listeners to point out some things they hear or say. And Melanie Dexter writes, she always hears instead of to flesh out an idea, she hears to flush out an idea, which, as she points out, she would think means almost the opposite.
Right. Of course, when one hears flush out, one thinks of like getting caustic substances in the eyes and having to...
Or other things.
Or other things, yes.
Getting rid of things. So it's not flush it out, it's flesh it out. Another listener, Kathy Cooksey, says, for some reason, when she wants to say mesmerize, she says memorize and vice versa.
There's certain pairings, as the writer mentioned, between mesmerize and memorize that are somewhat similar, and those are on a slips of the tongue. Why it happens, that's the realm of a cognitive scientist.
Right. Well, tell us more about what happens. Stay with mispronunciations. What are some common ones?
Well, the one that I hear the most about, everyone likes to point out how awful the word nuclear is. The word, of course, is nuclear. And the other big pet peeve is mischievous for mischievous. There's no I at the end of the word. It's V-O-U-S, and the word is pronounced mischievous.
Staying with pronunciation, how do you pronounce that thing that you get in sandwich shops, G-Y-R-O?
It honestly depends the degree to which your neighborhood has a Greek influence. If you're from a part of the country where there aren't a lot of Greeks, you're probably going to pronounce it gyro. If you're from a part of a country where there are a lot of Greek cafes and restaurants, you're going to more closely approximate the Greek pronunciation. The actual Greek consonant doesn't exist in English, and I can't quite do it, but something like gyro. There's another word in here, pina colada, or whether it's pina colada or pina colada. There, it's the degree to which one is familiar with Spanish or there's a Latin American influence in your neighborhood, whether you're going to call them pina colada or pina coladas. And it's been interesting. I've done shows where talk show hosts are insistent that, for example, it's gyro but pina colada or vice versa. And it's an issue of anglicization. Different people anglicize different words in different ways.
Yes, I like pina.
Okay, we just had to. We'll have more with Steve Kleinedler, one of the American Heritage Dictionary editors, in just 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back to our beloved occasional feature on language. Now, some listeners know that once, long ago, but on the air, I said I felt misled, meaning misled. Years later, I got some validation when my friend Paul Gazik said he felt mizzled. We asked you to tell us your language malaprops and pet peeves at hereandnow.org. Becca from Vermont has heard voluptuous instead of voluptuous. Don Bushman's wife says cleaverage instead of cleavage. Maybe a little more than we want to know there. Steve Kleinedler is one of the editors of the American Heritage Dictionaries who've put together several new books of words that we commonly mix up, misuse, or mispronounce. Steve, let's stay with some of the pronunciations. Start with D-O-U-R.
I personally say dour, which is considered a variant pronunciation and acceptable. The older pronunciation would be more like dour. It's not how I pronounce it, so I'm probably doing it
wrong.
But,
you know, that's when I've heard people flip that U-O a lot. They say dour.
Oh, dour, that's just wrong.
That's just wrong. That is just
wrong. You
can get
dour or dour, but dour would be, I would say that would be incorrect.
Okay, let's stay with mispronunciations. E-L-E-G-I-A-C.
The thing with this, some of these words, the issue is not that there's one right or one wrong, but actually that there are two correct pronunciations, but some people think it's one way or the other. In this case, you can say elegiac or elegiac.
You can?
Yeah.
Okay. How about, I'll say it the way I said it, harass. And then people say they don't like that back half of that word.
Oh, it's funny. Harass is interesting. Harris versus harass. The American Heritage Dictionary has a usage panel that consists of a couple hundred linguists, journalists, English teachers, writers, poets, and we periodically poll them on their views on English. And until recently, harass and harass was almost evenly split among them. Lately, harass has pulled slightly into the lead. But what's interesting is the comments that are made. Everyone seems to think their pronunciation is in the beleaguered minority, when actually it's, pretty split down the middle. With the case of this word, I'd say either is fine, but just pick one and use it and be consistent.
Yeah. Okay. Just stick with your beliefs.
With one. Yes.
All right. We know that people, and I've done this quite a bit, say beg the question when they mean raises. That raises the question. And you have other word pairs that people mix up.
Yeah.
Wrangle and wangle. Delegate and relegate.
Right.
What's the difference, wrangle and wangle?
Wrangle has something to do with to quarrel loudly, angrily, and wangle without the R means to achieve or get something by manipulating.
Well, and relegate is to put somebody in an inferior category. I didn't realize that it's sort of always in a downward trajectory.
Often. And delegate, of course, means to send someone else as one's representative
right.
to something else.
Right. Delegate someone to do something. Infer and imply.
Oh, this is great.
Yeah.
If you infer something, you are the listener or the reader making an assessment about what someone else has said. If you imply something, you are the speaker or the writer. As a speaker, you imply something and your reader or listener would infer it and not the other way around.
Oh, so infer is taking it in.
Yes.
Okay. Energize, enervate.
Ooh, this is a big one.
Yes.
Enervate, one here is misused quite a bit. Energize everyone, to impart energy to them.
Invigorate, yes.
Yes. enervate does not mean to energize. In fact, it means the exact opposite, to sap the vitality from something. So if, you buy
Isn't
this...
Isn't that something? That's a silly thing there, because... You infer from it that it sounds like it energizes.
It sounds like it does, but it really doesn't. And this is where, it can get you in trouble. If you're talking about some event that's really enervated you and you're all excited, what you're actually saying is it really tired you out and just completely depleted you of strength.
That's like producer Jill Ryan pointed out to me the other day, something I did not know. I always thought the phrase upwards of meant up to. So, the event had upwards of 10, meaning 1 through 10. It actually means upwards of 10 means above 10.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that also. Fix that.
No one ever said English made sense. In the 100 words, almost everyone mixes up or mangles. We also have idioms that people sometimes misspell. And in this book, there's a lot of words that sound alike but are spelled differently. So it's something that if you said, no one would ever know that you used the wrong word. But if you're writing, you could use the wrong word. And more importantly, it would be the type of error that a spell checker wouldn't pick up.
Give us an example.
A simple one would be the difference between hoard, like the hoarders who keep a lot of cats or papers and you can't get through their house, which is spelled H-O-A-R-D, and hoard, H-O-R-D-E, meaning a large crowd of people. Beyond that, there are idioms such as hold one's peace, make one's peace, speak one's peace. And some of these pieces are the P-E-A-C-E, and some of these pieces are the P-I-E-C-E pieces. For example, a piece of one's mind and say one's peace are spelled P-I-E-C-E, and keep or holds one's peace is spelled P-E-A-C-E.
Huh. Well, and while we're at it, we are here and now, H-E-R-E and now, as opposed to H-E-A-R and now, although you are hearing us. No.
It's a nice play on words, and one supposes that when the show title was invented, they were playing on that.
Yeah. Well, you would give us more credit than perhaps we deserve. We're talking to Steve Kleinadler, one of the many editors from the American Heritage Dictionary who compiled these three new books, words that people mispronounce, mix up or mangle, or misuse, and just a couple more of your favorites from any category.
Sure. I think one that's important to know has to do with the word inflammable. Some people think inflammable might mean not flammable, when in fact it's a synonym of flammable. Inflammable and flammable mean the same thing.
Wait, are you saying I-N?
I am. I-N-F-L-A-M-M-A-B-L-E means the same thing as flammable.
Oh, whereas I-M as in Mary means...
That's not a word. If you want to say not flammable, you would say non-flammable.
Do that again.
Yes.
I-N as in...
Nancy.
Nancy. Flammable means flammable. Flammable.
The in there is an intensive prefix and not a negative prefix.
And there is no such thing as I-M... As in Mary, inflammable?
Inflammable, no.
Huh, okay. Scratch that one off my list. I just want to mention one other one because it's in your book of 100 words almost everyone confuses and misuses. Mm-hmm. And it reminds us of the late, great Edwin Newman, the NBC broadcaster who just passed away. Who was incidentally
the first chair of our usage panel back in the 70s.
Who was a usage cop, and I got to work with him at NBC. And one that set his teeth grinding was... Hopefully. I hope I'm right on this, he actually came up with the phrase, abandon hopefully, all you who enter here, because...
That was supposedly over his office.
Over his office door.
Yeah.
There is no hopefully?
Traditionally, the sense it is to be hoped is considered non-standard or incorrect. I think the ship may have sailed on this. It is so used that, you know, people can continue to rail against it. But there are some battles not worth fighting. And we have a really long note here, and we point out there are other words like mercifully, frankly, that one could say the similar arguments against but are completely acceptable.
Well, or the one that my mother, the poor thing, she left us without ever correcting the world on this. More importantly...
Mm-hmm.
She would say, there is no Lee on, it's more important, but that's sort of, the horse is out of that barn too.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, listeners, be sure and let us know yours. Just go to hereandnow.org. We love to share these things. In the past, when we've solicited them, one of my favorites, Steve, a listener when she was very young, somebody wrote on her school paper that she had done it, well, she thought it said, super bly. And so for the rest of her life, she thought, wow, I am super bly.
That's funny.
But of course, superbly. So if you've got yours, go to hereandnow.org. Let us know. Steve Kleinedler, editor with American Heritage Dictionaries. There are 3 books for the verbally challenged. 100 words almost everyone confuses and misuses. 100 words almost everyone mispronounces. 100 words almost everyone mixes up or mangles. Steve, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Why can't the English teach their children how to speak? This verbal class distinction by now should be antique. If you spoke as she does, sir, instead of the way you do, why, you might be selling flowers too. I beg your pardon.